Chapter 6. Roles versus Characters. A role is not a character. A role simply assumes a generic position in a story's social order, such as mother, boss, artist, loner, and then carries out that role's tasks, feeding children, managing employees, painting canvases, avoiding people. Like a picture frame around an empty canvas, a role offers an artist a blank space that needs a character. When a fully realized character enters a story, he first assumes a basic role, but then fills it with his singular personality and executes the role's tasks in a unique manner, striking a one-of-a-kind relationship with each member of the cast. A cast's design strategically arranges its roles and relationships so that no two take the same position nor perform the same tasks in the same way. Cast formation. Characters come in casts, complete with complex networks of relationships. To sort these interconnections, picture a cast as a solar system of planets, moons, comets, and asteroids surrounding the star blazing at the center. Three concentric rings of supporting roles orbit the sun at various distances, affecting him and each other to greater or lesser degrees. The most influential characters cycle closest to the protagonist. Less impactful minor roles rotate further out, and at the farthest reaches, one scene only bit parts, non-speaking walk-ons, and crowds on streets complete the social universe. A third-person narrator, like an unseen god, views this cosmos from a distance. To design your cast, begin with the star role and expand to the outermost reaches. Protagonist. It takes guts to place a character front and center before readers and audiences and imply that this guy is so interesting, so involving, he deserves a major chunk of their precious time. So, before you take that step, let's examine the essential qualities of a protagonist. 1. Willpower. The mind, fearing extinction above all else, yearns for security. So when a story's inciting incident throws life out of kilter, the protagonist's instincts react as if his survival were at stake. He then conceives an object of desire, a physical, personal, or social objective that he feels would restore life's equilibrium. As he pursues this goal, antagonistic forces block his efforts. At the final crisis, he faces the story's most powerful, most focused oppositions. A true protagonist has the willpower to take on this ultimate dilemma, make the ultimate decision, and take the ultimate action as a last attempt to achieve his purpose and restore life's balance. His final action may fail, but not until he has exhausted his willpower. 2. Multiple capabilities. The protagonist's mental, emotional, and physical capacities combine to propel his life's pursuit to or beyond his personal limits. In every story, these capabilities are different. In one telling, he must be young enough, in another, old enough, rich enough or poor enough, educated or ignorant, and so on down the list of qualities that allow the reader audience to believe that the choices the protagonist makes and the actions he takes are his alone, true to his nature, and credible. The effect of his actions must go wide enough and or deep enough to bring the story to an ending beyond which the reader audience cannot imagine another. Once again, he may or may not get what he wants, but his efforts will ultimately reveal his full humanity. To expand events out wide into the story's social and physical settings, writers often find their protagonists amongst the elites, doctors, lawyers, warriors, politicians, scientists, detectives, executives, crime lords, celebrities, and the like. An elite's elevated status gives his actions broad consequence in the social hierarchy, driving the telling into more and more lives. When a story confounds events inward into the hidden realm, protagonists can be found in any walk of life, so long as they are complex enough to reward explorations of their depths and flexible enough to undergo change. And, of course, a story can take its protagonist both wide and deep at once. Consider, for example, Jimmy McGill in the long-form series Breaking Bad and its prequel Better Call Saul. When Jimmy's story opens, he's a charming, gregarious street hustler and wannabe lawyer. But when he hides behind the persona of Saul Goodman, he buries his true self deeper and deeper inside. At the same time, his storefront legal career expands wider and wider until he's embroiled in a billion-dollar meth empire. 3. An underdog status. Do this. Put your protagonist in the palm of one hand and weigh his mental, emotional, and physical capacities. Then, in the other, add up the power of all antagonistic forces he will confront over the course of the story. Negative thoughts and feelings from his inner life, personal conflicts with friends, family, and lovers, all obstructing institutions and the people in them, and finally, the physical world, from foul weather to lethal diseases to never enough time. When you test the strength of your protagonist against the concentrated force of all negative powers, you should see that the forces of antagonism virtually overwhelm him. He is clearly an underdog. He has a chance of achieving his object of desire, but just that, a chance. 4. An empathetic nature. The moment a reader or an audience member enters a fictional world, he quickly inspects the story's value-charged universe, sorting positives from negatives, rights from wrongs, goods from evils, things of interest from things of no interest, searching for the center of good, a secure place to attach his empathy. Definition: the center of good is a positive charge of value, for example, justice, goodness, love, etc., glowing deep within a story that contrasts with a dark negative charge, for example, tyranny, evil, hate, etc., that surrounds it. This positive light attracts empathy because human beings, in their heart of hearts, feel that they are overall good or right, and so they naturally identify with their perception of the positive. With a few exceptions, most stories locate their center of good in the protagonist. 2 examples: Mario Puzo's Godfather trilogy creates a criminal universe of mafia families surrounded by corrupt cops and for-hire judges. But the Corleone family has one positive quality: loyalty. The other crime families betray one another and stab each other in the back. That makes them the bad, bad guys. The Godfather's family sticks together and defends each other, making them the good bad guys. When an audience finds this positive center in the Corleones, they instinctively identify with gangsters. In The Silence of the Lambs, novelist Thomas Harris splits the reader's focus toward two centers of good. The heroism of FBI agent Clarice Starling draws immediate empathy, but as the story unfolds, a second hub of affinity forms in Dr. Hannibal Lecter. First, Harris places Lecter in a dark, dishonorable world. The FBI attempts to bribe him with a false offer of a prison cell with an ocean view. His jailer is a sadist and publicity hound. The cops Lecter kills are dullards. Second, bright lights glow within Lecter. He has a massive IQ, a keen sense of humor, and a remarkably calm, polite manner while living in hell. Lecter's positive qualities inside a negative society cause the reader to shrug and think, so he eats people. There are worse things. Offhand, I can't think what, but there must be. The reader identifies thinking, if I were a psychopathic, cannibalistic serial killer, I'd want to be just like Lecter. He's cool. 5. Intrigue. A story's protagonist is its most complex and therefore most intriguing character. When two qualities within a character contradict each other, the reader audience naturally wonders, who is this guy? Pursuing the answer to that question glues them to the telling. 6. Length and depth. The protagonist stands in the story's foreground and occupies the reader's audience's mind for the greater part of the telling. As a result, his subconscious motivations and hidden desires are ultimately revealed with each pressure-filled choice he makes. By climax, this exposure makes him the character known in the greatest depth. 7. Capacity for change. Human beings gather knowledge over time, discover new beliefs, adapt to new conditions, and adjust to an aging body, but their inner natures tend to stay fixed, and their core selves, with few exceptions, do not change. They may daydream about change, especially for the better, but that's more wish fulfillment than likelihood. Because most human beings keep their essential selves intact over a lifetime, characters who do not change seem the most true to life, the most realistic. For those characters who do change, the more they arc, the more they lean away from the realistic and toward the symbolic. A character progressing to the positive evolves toward the ideal. One descending to the negative devolves toward a dark archetype. Of all cast members, the one most likely to undergo change is the protagonist. Protagonists may reform like Scrooge in A Christmas Carol, or Jesse Pinkman in Breaking Bad, or learn their lesson like Theo Decker in The Goldfinch, or Fleabag in Fleabag, or degenerate like Jackie Payton in Nurse Jackie, or Truman Capote in Capote, or become disillusioned like Tony Webster in The Sense of an Ending, or David Lurie in Disgrace, or grow into their author like Davy Copperfield in David Copperfield, or Stephen Dedalus in A Portrait of the Artist as a Young Man. 8. Insight. When conflict throws a character's life out of balance, his mind seeks insight into how and why things happen, how and why people do the things they do. The most powerful conflicts fester in the protagonist, making this character the one most likely to experience an epiphany. In ancient times, the word epiphany named the moment a deity suddenly appeared before its awestruck worshippers. In the modern usage, the term means a flash of insight into reality, an intuitive perception of an essential cause or force hidden beneath the surface of things. When a protagonist undergoes an epiphany, a startling realization spins him from ignorance to knowledge, from unawareness to a mind-blazing truth. With this flash of acuity, his life pivots and the consequences make or break him. Tragedies often climax on an epiphany of identity, a startling flash of self-recognition as the protagonist suddenly discovers the truth of who he really is. When Sophocles' Oedipus realizes that he is his wife's son and his father's murderer, he gouges out his eyes. Shakespeare's Othello drives a knife into his heart when he realizes that he was duped into murdering his innocent wife. In Anton Chekhov's The Seagull, Konstantin kills himself when he realizes Nina will never love him. In The Empire Strikes Back, when Luke Skywalker discovers that Darth Vader is his father, he attempts suicide. In a classical comedy, a humble servant learns that he has an identical twin with an identifying mole. Their mother gave birth on a storm-tossed sea, and they were swept apart. What's more, their mother is queen of a distant land, making them heirs to a fortune. 2,400 years of comedy writing later, Larry David, in an episode of Curb Your Enthusiasm, learns that he is not Jewish, but was adopted from a very Christian, very Scandinavian family in Minnesota. After visiting his birth family, Larry realizes he'd rather be a Jew. Beyond discoveries of identity, epiphanies often expose a disquieting insight. In his last soliloquy, Macbeth laments that life has no more meaning than a tale told by an idiot. 400 years later, in Samuel Beckett's Waiting for Godot, Panzo bemoans the brevity of life. He imagines a woman in labor, straddling a pit, her baby's life lived in the time it takes to fall out of her womb and into a tomb. As he puts it, they give birth astride a grave. The light gleams an instant, and then it's night once more. In Nurse Jackie, Jackie Payton's epiphany forces her to admit that she turned to drugs because she couldn't cope with her firstborn's endless crying. Her addiction, therefore, is her own fault. This truth, however, fails to save her life because she hasn't the willpower to quit. Epiphanies are all or nothing events, and for that reason, dangerous. They may create a story's most magnificent, memorable moment, or its most embarrassingly overwritten moment. On stage or on screen, an epiphany demands excellent writing before, during, and after the character's burst of insight, and an excellent actor to pull it off. At the Act 3 climax of Casablanca, for example, when Rick gazes into his future and says, "It seems that destiny has taken a hand," the audience enjoys a plunge into the ocean of subtext beneath his words. Prose epiphanies, however, pose an even greater risk. A rush of illumination igniting a character's mind tests not only an author's gift for language, but the reader's imagination and the character's credibility. That's why prose descriptions of meaning-packed, life-changing, all-at-once insights often turn purple. Protagonist variations. In most stories, the protagonist is a single human being, man, woman, child. This central role, however, can be filled in a variety of ways. Co-protagonists. Rather than creating one multidimensional protagonist, you can achieve complexity by uniting two characters with sharply contrasting qualities into a duet of co-protagonists. On the page, Rudyard Kipling's The Man Who Would Be King melds Daniel Dravot and Peachy Carnahan into a multifaceted team. Crime series such as Janet Ivanovich and Lee Goldberg's Fox and O'Hara novels also employ co-protagonists. On screen, William Goldman joined the Sundance Kid with Butch Cassidy. Kelly Currie did the same for Louise and Thelma. Dick Wolf cast co-protagonists in his long-running series Law and Order as teams of police and prosecutors. On stage, modernist works such as Tom Stoppard's Rosencrantz and Guildenstern Are Dead, Beckett's Waiting for Godot, Ionesco's The Chairs, use dual protagonists, but not to create complexity. Rather, for the opposite reason, to stress sameness. Each duet is dimensionless, non-realistic, and virtually indistinguishable. Group protagonists. A collection of characters becomes a story's protagonist under two conditions. One, despite superficial differences, at heart, they all share the same desire. Two, as they struggle to reach their goals, they suffer and benefit mutually. What happens to one affects them all. If one individual has a success, they all share in it and move forward together. If one has a loss, they all fall back together. Film examples: The Seven Samurai, The Dirty Dozen, Inglourious Basterds. How large can a group protagonist become? In Battleship Potemkin, Sergei Eisenstein casts thousands of sailors and citizens in a revolt against tyranny. In October, 10 days that shook the world, Russia's entire working-class population became Eisenstein's massive plural protagonist. Multi-protagonists. Multi-plot tellings have no central plot. Instead, they unite a number of storylines around a theme, and then either cross-cut them, as in the film Crash, or string them end-to-end, as in the film Wild Tales. Each has its own protagonist. Split protagonists. In novels such as Robert Louis Stevenson's The Strange Case of Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde, and Chuck Palahniuk's Fight Club, two sides of a split personality struggle for control of a protagonist's moral self. On screen, Woody Allen's Crimes and Misdemeanors, two cross-cut stories mirror each other until their protagonists merge in the audience's mind as one weak-willed, immoral, self-deceived loser. Charlie Kaufman's adaptation and every film that ever featured a werewolf do much the same. Passive protagonists. When a storyteller shifts to an inner battlefield and engages in psychological warfare over a protagonist's morality, mentality, or humanity. The character may seem passive to those around him. Because his unexpressed thoughts rarely convert to action, outwardly, he floats through his days, a philosophical tourist with a paralyzed persona, while inwardly, he wages a desperate but invisible struggle not to make the same mistake again and again, or to calm a mind flooded with too many choices, or to force a choice between the lesser of two evils. Examples: in Anna Burns' Milkman, an unnamed protagonist reads novels while walking, doing her best to avoid life and a creepy stalker. In About Schmidt, Schmidt, played by Jack Nicholson, spends his retirement years writing letters to an orphan in Africa, filled with regrets about his life, past, present, and future. Switching protagonists. When a character misleads the reader audience into believing that he's the story's protagonist and then dies, exits, or turns into an antagonist, the story jolts in a radically new direction. For the first half of The Killing Fields, Sidney Schamburg, an American journalist, plays the protagonist, but as he flees the Cambodian genocide, the story torch passes to his cameraman, Dith Pran, who takes over the film and carries it to climax. Psycho kills its protagonist halfway through the film, making her death all the more shocking and the villain far more frightening. The victim's sister and boyfriend then step in as co-protagonists. Metaphorical protagonists. Metaphors for humanity. Cartoons like Bugs Bunny. Animals like Babe. Inanimate objects like Wall-E can become protagonists if, in the face of conflict, they make free will choices to pursue their desires. First circle characters. The first circle contains major characters who help or hinder, focus or defocus, support or service the protagonist. A support role changes the course of events. A service role does not. In a classic crime story, for example, the cop who discovers a murder victim's body is a service character. The coroner, who deduces a clue to the killer's identity, is a support character. The detective who apprehends and punishes the killer is the protagonist. A role, whether supporting or servicing, becomes major when multiple traits and dimensions round out his character, while at the same time, his unique actions and single-minded purpose invites readers and audiences to picture his life outside the enacted events. In other words, a major character has the potential for a story of his own. These roles have many possible uses. Subplot protagonists. The protagonist of a subplot that intersects the central plot and affects its course of action is a major support character. The protagonist of a subplot that runs parallel to the central plot, but does not affect its course, is a major service character. In The Godfather, for example, Michael's ascension to Godfather arcs the central plot. The Tasio betrayal subplot turns and supports this arc, while the love story subplot deepens and services his character. The focal character. A cast's focal character is the role that draws the most interest from the reader audience and is therefore almost always the protagonist. In rare tellings, however, A character who adds exceptional energy or excitement to the story becomes the focus of attention and decenters the telling away from the protagonist. Antonio is the title character of Shakespeare's The Merchant of Venice, but Shylock steals the spotlight. Clarice Darling plays protagonist in The Silence of the Lambs, but Hannibal Lecter draws focus. Christine is the protagonist of Gaston Leroux's novel The Phantom of the Opera, but the focal character is the phantom. The foil character. In the 18th century, jewelers found that by backing a diamond with a thin sheet of reflective foil, they could double the gem's intensity. Writers put this same principle to work when they use a foil role to enhance the protagonist. Foils service protagonists in numerous ways. One, they illuminate the protagonist. When a thing is compared to its opposite, understanding sharpens. A black chair sitting against a white wall seems all the more dark. To hone your protagonist's image, stand him next to a counterpointing foil. Examples: Sancho Panza, Dr. Watson, and Arnold Rothstein are three chubby foils who comically contrast with their rail-thin protagonists Don Quixote, Sherlock Holmes, and Nucky Thompson. The duo of Mr. Spock and Captain Kirk pit solemn seriousness against fun-loving daring. Casablanca juxtaposes Captain Renault's sexual adventures to Rick's romantic anguish. Victor Laszlo's anti-fascist heroism to Rick's political indifference. Dual protagonists, such as Thelma and Louise, Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid, act as each other's foil. Two, they see what the protagonist cannot. The protagonist's struggle to reach his object of desire often blinds him as the spine of action sweeps him from one impulsive judgment to another. A calm foil may serve as the voice of reason. Example: in the long-form series Ozark, husband and wife, Marty and Wendy Bird, Jason Bateman and Laura Linney, take turns playing each other's foil. When one loses sight of their goal and acts impulsively, the other calms him or her down and refocuses the couple's spine of action. Three, they contradict the protagonist's morality. A foil could define the protagonist by striking either a morally superior or an inferior counterpoint. Examples: in Mean Streets, the criminally crazed Johnny Boy, played by Robert De Niro, is the childhood pal of the deeply religious Charlie, played by Harvey Keitel. In Nurse Jackie, the steady-handed Dr. Eleanor O'Hara, played by Eve Best, balances the wild gyrations of Jackie Payton, played by Edie Falco. In Platoon, the good Sergeant Ellis, played by William Defoe, and the evil Sergeant Barnes, played by Tom Berenger, fight for the soul of Private Chris Taylor, played by Charlie Sheen. In A Tale of Two Cities, Charles Dickens creates two characters who look as alike as twins, but then polarizes them into the noble Charles Darnay versus the corrupt Sidney Carton. Bury an immoral foil in the subconscious of a morally pure mind, and he becomes the strange case of Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde. Four, they guide us to the protagonist. To create story-long suspense, an author may wrap his protagonist in mystery. No backstory, no friends, no confessions. This arouses intense curiosity about the character's unspoken thoughts and desires, his true feelings and plans. Having provoked questions about the inner life, the writer then withholds the answers to create tension. The reader audience, with nowhere else to turn, looks to other characters, especially a foil, for clues and insights. The foil may only partly understand the protagonist, or for that matter, may completely misunderstand him, but in either case, every time the foil interacts with the protagonist, the reader audience learns a little something about the central character. What could be true? What is not true? What more they need to know? A wise foil may funnel deep perspectives into the protagonist's hidden truths. If, for example, the central character's nature is more than mysterious, if he undergoes experiences of a unique intensity beyond even the most worldly wise reader audience, if the protagonist is a saint, genius, or madman like Captain Ahab, then the reader audience will need an Ishmael to pilot them through the churning depths of obsession, or, more recently, a Dr. Melfi to make sense of the chaos raging inside Tony Soprano. 5. They interpret a protagonist's epiphany. When a protagonist undergoes a sudden, massive epiphany, he may respond to it quietly, inwardly, secretly. The change this causes may never reveal itself overtly, but a foil who knows him well can read his enigmatic behaviors and interpret his flashes of insight. The foil then becomes a Jesse Pinkman to the protagonist's Walter White. 6. They interpret the protagonist's complexities. Epiphanies aside, multidimensional characters often need more than one foil to guide the reader audience to a full understanding of the protagonist's inner machinations. Consider the long-form series Succession. The clear-thinking Kendall Roy, plus his three scheming siblings, Connor, Siobhan, and Roman, as well as Carolina, Frank, and other corporate survivors, all give us slivers of insight into the ruthless Logan Roy. 7. They ground the protagonist in his setting. A complex protagonist often strikes us as an extraordinary human being, so extraordinary, in fact, that he may project archetypal overtones such as warrior, healer, trickster, goddess, magician, etc. The more a protagonist's qualities inflate toward the symbolic, the more he risks losing credibility in the eyes of the reader audience. The protagonists of Shakespeare's tragedies, Hemingway's novels, and the DC universe all take this high-speed risk. The safety belt is a down-to-earth foil, a Horatio for Hamlet, an Anselmo for Robert Jordan, a Lois Lane for Clark Kent. Because foils seem typical of their society, they ground the protagonist in reality and yet, at the same time, make him seem unique. In fact, a story's entire cast can be seen as a massive foil that gives the protagonist weight and credibility. We'll hear more of this in Chapter 17. The POV Character. Point of view is normally funneled through the protagonist, but not always. Dr. Watson, a first-person narrator, is the POV character in Arthur Conan Doyle's Sherlock Holmes stories, but Holmes is both protagonist and focal character. Nick Carraway and Jay Gatsby strike the same relationship in F. Scott Fitzgerald's The Great Gatsby. Major support roles. From the protagonist's point of view, major support characters either help him or hinder him. Some influence events to the positive, others to the negative. They further or block his efforts, bending him either toward or away from his object of desire. Chief amongst these are antagonistic characters who directly oppose the protagonist's struggle to rebalance life. In action genres from high adventure to crime to horror, we call these characters villains. They range from purely evil monsters to complex antiheroes. In the six character-driven genres that are coming up in Chapter 14, the protagonist often discovers that he is his own worst enemy. Major service roles. A major service role seems to have a life of his own going on outside the reader audience's view. He doesn't turn the story's events, and they don't change him. He has a fixed personality combined with a kind of freedom, so that regardless of the story's outcome, he is an end in himself who can't be otherwise. Any function he serves seems to happen as he passes through the story. For example, in Charles Dickens' Bleak House, Miss Flight is a sweet, elderly, delusional woman obsessed with lawsuits. Her family was destroyed by a long-running case, and so she sits in court every day watching trials, some comic, others tragic. She says things people think crazy, but they turn out to have a symbolic meaning. She owns a bevy of caged birds that she plans to set free on Judgment Day. A character can fulfill any one or all of these major functions. However, if such creatures become overly interesting and out of proportion to their cast functions, they may mutiny, take over the telling, and sink it. In The Fighter, for example, the protagonist, Mickey Ward, played by Mark Wahlberg, seemed rather bland compared to Dickie Eklund, played by Christian Bale, who nearly steals the film. Second circle characters. By limiting a character's dimensions to just one, for example, sad, cheerful, or even less, a single trait, always cheerful, and then reducing his appearance time, you can compress an entire human being inside a role from the middle circle. Nonetheless, all levels of conflict operate in all human beings. Therefore, no character, not even the lowliest bit part, should be imagined on only one plane. Which level you emphasize must fit your purpose. For reasons of exposition, you may choose to make a coffee shop cook a gossip, but giving thought to his inner, private, and personal selves may enrich his banter with an amusing style. Second circle support roles. Middle ground support characters help or hinder a story's course, but do not have a personal magnetism to interest us beyond the scenes they're in. No one cares what Claudius or Laertes do when Hamlet's not around, how Milo Minderbender spends his day without John Usarian in Catch-22, what Ida Sessions feels when she's not on the phone to J.J. Gittes in Chinatown. Second circle service roles. The chief asset of a second circle service role is predictability of behavior. Archetypes, for example, Earth Mother, or types, the Klutz, or Stocks, the gym trainer, ground a story's setting. Their single external trait may vary from scene to scene. A loudmouth, for example, is loud in different ways on the phone or in a restaurant, but he's always loud. If that changes, he's either not the same character or he's added a dimension. Third circle characters. Minor characters move at the greatest distance from the protagonist, usually appearing only once in a telling and almost always playing a service role. On rare occasions, a bit part may be given a moment of intensity, for example, a terrified face in a horror film, but generally they are kept dimensionless and anonymous. The bus driver, for example. Like a newscaster on a television playing in the background, minor roles may pour exposition into the telling, but like dead bodies on a battlefield, they're props that service the plot. These nether reaches include the background masses, the social component of a story setting. Like a crowd screaming in a stadium, they represent the density of people through which principal characters must move. Narrators. Narrators provide readers and audiences with exposition about the story's physical and social settings, past lives of the cast, as well as the traits and qualities of observable behaviors in the characters. Narrators come in multiple varieties depending on person, medium, and reliability. First, three possible persons. 1. A first-person narrator is a character who tells his story from the page, stage, or voiceover, speaking directly to the eavesdropping reader audience. 2. A second-person narrator speaks as if he were the reader audience personally experiencing the story's events. Instead of the pronouns I, me, or she, he, they, the author calls on the pronoun you, as in, you fool, look what you've done now. You turns the reader audience into a protagonist, musing and straining within himself. 3. A third-person narrator is not a character, but rather the voice of knowledge and awareness an author adapts to convey exposition. This mind exists outside events, and therefore the reader audience has no interest in its well-being or its future. These three storytellers may inhabit any of the three media. They may or may not know all relevant facts, may or not be honest about them, even if they do, and therefore, from the reader audience's point of view, they may or may not be 100% reliable. But in either case, their relative reliability must serve the author's purpose. Reliable narrators. On stage. First-person narrators, such as Tom Wingfield in Tennessee Williams's The Glass Menagerie, tell us facts, although his emotional memories often cloud his recollections. Second-person narration calls the audience up on stage and invites them to participate and improvise. Third-person narrators, such as the stage manager in Thornton Wilder's Our Town, or the narrator in Irwin Pescador's stage adaptation of War and Peace, are wise and reliable. On the page. First-person novels are often narrated by quiet, empathetic characters who observe adventurous, duplicitous characters. The Great Gatsby, Bride's Head Revisited, and All the King's Men, and their like. Full-length second-person narration is difficult to pull off. For example, Jay McInerney's Bright Lights, Big City is a famous exception. and for that reason, rare. Trustworthy, all-knowing, third-person narrators have told novels since their invention. Jonathan Franzen's The Corrections is a 21st century example. On screen. The first-person narrators of Annie Hall and Memento tell the truth as they understand it. In a second-person experiment, the camera in Lady of the Lake becomes the protagonist, and with that, the audience's eyes, and then stays locked in that subjective point of view as it moves throughout the film. In Y Tu Mama También, the third-person narrator is worldly and reliable. The unreliable narrator. When one character lies to another, and we see the deception for what it is, this insight enriches our experience. But if a narrator, such as Roger Verbal Kint, played by Kevin Spacey in The Usual Suspects, deliberately deceives us, what purpose does unreliable exposition serve? Why would a writer mislead us about fictional facts? Two reasons. Enhanced credibility and enhanced curiosity. Enhanced credibility. Dimensionless roles that symbolize pure ideas such as wisdom, innocence, good, evil, and the like, only feel at home in fantasies and allegories. Flawless characters seem unreal. Real people are scarred with imperfections. They misperceive the world around them and self-deceive the truth within themselves for at least two reasons. First, the natural human tendency to distort and misinterpret facts, to rationalize and excuse failures, to gain advantage with feints and lies. Second, in an insane mind, memory disconnects from reality itself. But even in the most rational mind, memory is notoriously unreliable. In realistic tellings, therefore, imperfect narrators reflect our human reality and gain a greater credibility. But beyond their flaws, the foremost reason for unreliability in first-person narrators is that sooner or later, they talk about themselves. And when they do, truth becomes difficult. As noted previously, whenever a line of dialogue begins with the pronoun I, what follows is, to some degree, a lie. The mind finds unvarnished honesty about itself next to impossible. A self-protective shield softens the blow. As a result, all statements of self are self-serving, while at the same time ironically deepening the reader audience's belief in the character. Greater curiosity. When a first-person narrator lies, a character lies. For example, throughout Ian Banks's novel The Wasp Factory, Frank, the narrator, tells us that as an infant, he was attacked by a vicious dog and castrated. At the novel's climax, however, Frank reveals that in fact his father fed him lies about the dog attack, as well as experimental hormones, ever since he was too little to remember. Now in his teens, Frank confesses that he is, and always has been, a girl. With that, the reader's curiosity leaps from surprise to shock. When a third-person narrator lies, an author lies. Unreliability in a third-person narrator seems self-defeating. The very reason an author assumes a third-person voice is to build the reader's trust in fictional facts, So when third-person narrators distort exposition, the reader audience either tosses the story aside in annoyance or grows ever more interested. Some authors simply tell us on page one that they are no more trustworthy than a character. In Slaughterhouse-Five, for example, Kurt Vonnegut delights in calling attention to his fallibility, making us wonder what's true, what's false, and if those terms even matter. For those who go along with these authors, curiosity about trustworthiness multiplies tension. Faulty interpretations and biased beliefs are easily expressed in images and language. With just a slight warp of point of view, each mode becomes unreliable. For that reason, the two most subjective media for storytelling are the screen and the page. On screen. Unreliable first person. Protagonists may become unreliable due to faulty memories, for example, the television series How I Met Your Mother, faulty knowledge, for example, Forrest Gump, or outright deceit, The Usual Suspects. In the long-form series The Affair, the co-protagonists see the same event from two very different POVs. In Rashomon, four characters recall the same fateful event in four radically different ways. In The Man Who Lies, the same character tells his wartime story seven different ways, depending on who he's talking to and what he wants out of them. Unreliable second person. This has yet to be attempted on screen, but may await us in the future of virtual reality. Unreliable third person. A film's writer, director, editor can distort a story's past in various ways. A false flashback, as in The Cabinet of Dr. Caligari, a false reality, as in A Beautiful Mind, or a falsified history, in Glorious Bastards. On the page. Unreliable first person. Authors often call on unreliability to express an unstable mind. For example, the unnamed narrator of Edgar Allan Poe's The Telltale Heart and Chief Bromden in Ken Kesey's One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest. The same is true for protagonists burdened with ignorance or immaturity, such as Holden Caulfield in The Catcher in the Rye. When the narrator purposely deceives the reader, unreliability is the M.O., as in Agatha Christie's The Murder of Roger Ackroyd. In Caroline Kepnes's You, Joe, the first-person narrator recounts his romance with Guinevere, the love of his life, until he murders her. In Ian Pearce's An Instance of the Finger Post, four characters, one of whom is insane, tell the same story from their biased points of view until the reader has no clear idea of what actually happened. Unreliable second person. In A Prayer for the Dying by Stuart Onan, the you as protagonist slowly goes mad. Unreliable third person. In Home by Toni Morrison, narration splits between the protagonist in the first person and the author as a seemingly omniscient third person. These alternating voices, however, often contradict one another. Because war and racial violence have poisoned the protagonist's memory, the facts fail him. But then, the same becomes true for the narrator as she realizes that no one can know anything for certain. On stage. The theater is storytelling's most objective medium. For 25 centuries, audiences have treated the stage as a viewing platform to display characters who do not see us so we can see them for who they are. This rigorously reliable third-person form demands imaginative writing and staging to orient a theater audience to see things through an unreliable first, second, or third-person sensibility. Unreliable first person. In Dancing at Lunasa, contradictions between the onstage narrator's memories of his childhood and the lives of his five older sisters make us realize that there are as many pasts as there are minds to remember it. Unreliable second person. In Florian Zeller's The Father, the stage itself becomes the mind of a man with dementia. The audience, as if living inside the protagonist's head, senses his desperate struggle to control reality. A character introduced as his daughter in one scene reappears in the next, played by a different actor, suddenly becoming a stranger to him and us. Two seemingly sequential moments, we slowly realize, in fact, happened 10 years apart. As his confusion grows, so does ours. Until finally, his inner chaos evokes a direct and personal experience of what it must be like when your mind falls apart. Unreliable third person. In Mark Haden's novel, The Curious Incident of the Dog in the Nighttime, Christopher, an autistic first-person narrator, tells us a uniquely eccentric story. To translate his mind's distortions, the London stage used literal smoke, mirrors, and ear-pounding sound to express the terrifying unreliability of autism.